Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is Tom Carrico of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the think tank's man on air and missile defense, unmanned systems defense as well. Pretty much everything from mud to space falls in Tom's purview. Tom, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Vaka. Always a pleasure to be here. And we hope that the missiles are unmanned.
Yeah, exactly. It's in terra. I was going to say terra incognita, but not really, right? That takes us back to another generation. So God willing, we don't have any of that. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. New administration, Tom, you and I have spent a lot of time over the years talking about missile defense and what the needs of the country are given the nature of the changing threat. And I just wanted to survey with you sort of where this new administration is going to be, because at the lower end of missile defense, I think everybody has an understanding, whether it's guided rocket, missile, artillery, there's an importance for defense. On cruise missile defense, there is agreement. Whereas once you get to the higher ends, the national missile defense, it does become almost a religious issue, right? The right tends to be a lot more passionate about it, whereas the left tends to be a little bit cooler on its approach and potential concerns about ballistic missile defense treaties and the like, even though I think, you know, we've sort of abrogated that. And of course, the adversary always gets a vote, right? So as American missile defenses improve, the Russians start developing things like the Poseidon long-range nuclear torpedo and things like that. Let's start at the mud level. Full disclosure, Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, the maker of the Iron Dome system, sponsors us. Let's start at the low level, right? What's this new administration's approach and policy? I know there's an ongoing missile defense review, but if you can give us kind of an insight on, you know, as we march up through each of these layers, what their stance is.
Right. Well, I think you're right to kind of look at the full spectrum from mud to space, as you say, starting at the UAS stuff at the low level.
And that's unmanned aerial system.
Right. And I'll just say that the, I think it was in January of this year, the Pentagon put out a kind of a path forward to kind of contend with lower level UAS types, and recognizing that we've seen this problem coming for a very long time, and we've just kind of let it creep up on us, in part, I think, because we have the habit of assuming air superiority. And we're hopefully shaking that habit a little bit per the NDS. And we've had a couple events over the past couple years, whether it's the Iranian attack on Opcake, or I would say really an even better example is the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict last year, where, you know, UAVs were used to good effect to attack and disable some higher end air defense systems, the S-300 that was used there in a much publicized event. So you got that low end problem. I would just say is depicted very nicely in the most recent, I think it's not Olympus Has Fallen, but the sequel to that Angel Has Fallen movie. If you haven't seen that, I highly encourage it. Okay. Then there's kind of moving up the chain a little bit. You got your cruise missile defense problem and your short range air defense, SHORAD problem. The U.S. just deployed the first Stryker maneuver SHORAD units to Europe in the past week or so. That's a good move, kind of correcting the disestablishment of SHORAD that we had done kind of in the heyday of counterterrorism attention. That's all for the good. There's going to be a shoot off on the IFPC, which is the indirect fire protection capability, but it's really kind of about not really rockets, artillery, and mortars, but also cruise missile defense. And the lack of cruise missile defense has really been a really significant long running saga that has it really affected the joint force broadly. IFPC is an Army program. There's going to be a shoot off this fall for that. But it's interesting, you know, the Air Force is starting to look at that as well. And so places in Indo-PACOM that really need cruise missile defense for for China threat, they're getting a lot of attention.
You're absolutely right, Tom, right? I mean, our behavior has been as if adversaries don't exist and they're not fielding these sorts of systems. And the Chinese in particular have been extremely methodical the cruise missile side of things, on the short range missile side of things, on the intermediate range, on the ballistic missile range, on the area denial, and on the precision right. strike, whether it's DF-21, DF-26. I mean, this variety of layered systems to allow Chinese forces to reach out. Talk to us a little bit about where the administration is on systems like Patriot, on the PAC-3, as well as on the THAAD and Aegis systems, right? I mean, this sort of higher end baseline that we're looking at that constitutes the bulk of our defensive forces. Where are we on investment, and where are we on actually extending their range and capability to match the sort of adversarial capabilities we're facing?
Right. Well, you know, a lot of these systems were developed. Well, Patriot first began as an air defense asset, but THAAD and Aegis BMD, of course, were mostly focused on the rogue state ballistic missile threat. You mentioned, kind of how the enemy is adapted. I like to say that we put the Russians on notice 30 years ago about our intent for brilliant pebbles and space-based exo-atmospheric interceptors. And what has happened? The threat has gone lower, not just for things like the Poseidon, but the whole field of hypersonic gliders. I mean, that's kind of at an altitude that is, I would say, deliberately trying to evade our even prospective development of exo-atmospheric kill vehicles, but also kind of being above some of our lower tier air defenses. So look, Patriot and THAAD, these are high demand assets. The Patriot force, I think, is the highest op-tempo in the joint force, even more than some of the special operations stuff, which is really remarkable. So there's no shortage of demand for that. The combatant commanders always want more of that. THAAD, of course, is in Guam and the Korean Peninsula, and there's some good modernization efforts going on to make THAAD more agile and to have it talk to Patriot better. And then you mentioned Aegis. The demand signal for the destroyers to get more of that capability, that's all goodness. But there's also the prospect of a new, I would say, Aegis Ashore-like facility on Guam. And the outgoing Indo-PACOM commander, Admiral Davidson, has been banging the table on this, saying he needs 360-degree capability. It sounds like Aegis Ashore that he's talking about, and he needs it now because of the China threat.
I mean, it's a brilliant idea. I mean, there was a lot of consternation during the Obama years when we withdrew our national missile defense interceptors from Poland. But actually, the system we put in place was a superior system and had better coverage in terms of Aegis Ashore. And once you pioneer that, then Guam is a very logical place to try to put it. But as a friend of mine put it, he's a retired Navy two-star, said, I mean, this is sort of the six levels of Dante's Inferno in order to try to do this, right? I mean, it would be the Army's got the mission, the Navy has the technology, the Air Force has the need, and how do you get somebody to pay for it, right? How do we get somebody to pay for it?
Well,
right? What's the right way to do this?
I think you mentioned it was a friend who was in the Navy who posed that question. And I like the way in which they assume that the Army will be operating it. That's an open question. The Navy would like the Army to operate it if it gets put there. But there's a push and pull on that question. I think the Army could be well suited for that, but they would need to get the TOA, to get the budget authority, so that they can man up. Army Air Defense Artillery Force is extremely strapped in terms of manning right now. I'm going to be hosting General Carbler, head of SMDC, Space Missile Defense Command, here in a couple of weeks at CSIS. Nice little advertisement there. And they had to pull crews off THAAD so that they could go staff Iron Dome. They have to make those kind of choices. And so, yeah, I think it does make sense to have something like Aegis Ashore for Guam. And by the way, Aegis Ashore for Guam would be very different than the Aegis Ashores in Eastern Europe, which are strictly about the Iranian ballistic threat. Aegis Ashore for Guam is about the full, in the first instance, aerial threats, cruise missiles, things like that. And it's not about a rogue state. It's about the big guys. It's about China. So it's going to be a different configuration, I suspect, and it's going to be integrated with a lot of other things that we have in that region. I think in terms of paying for it, that's part of the Pacific Deterrence Initiative that's been put to Congress in that 1251 report, and it was the number one priority in that report was to get this 360 defense of Guam.
Are you optimistic that it will be executed?
I am optimistic, and I think that, again, putting it right there at the top of the list, unless you want to just say, look, we're not going to defend Guam, we're just going to abandon Guam, then you have to have something. Passive defense is great. Distributed operations is fantastic, but you can't move or hide an island like Guam. And it's a central node for our power projection in the Pacific, so I think you need something like that. So yeah, I'm optimistic. I think it's the right thing to do. We got to make sure that it is survivable to the fullest extent possible. And by the way, we may need to take assets like Patriot out of the Middle East. Some of that is coming out of the Middle East, and I think that's for the good, and move those to what we say is our central theater, which is Indo-PACOM.
Architecturally, Tom, do we have the right kinds of capability to counter what it is that the Chinese are increasingly fielding and are going to be threatening our bases across the region with, right? I mean, is there, or what are the sorts of things we need to be doing above and beyond what we're doing now to make sure that we have that capability, especially given that both China and Russia, and we can quibble about whether or not these are fully operational, sort of operational, right? Folks are going to hypersonics for a whole variety of reasons, in part because intercepting them is much, much harder, right? I mean, ballistic intercept is hard. A hypersonic intercept is an order of magnitude more difficult. Are we fielding the right capability in the face of the threat, right? Because deterrence works only insofar as the adversary goes, ah, crap, they can counter it. The minute you think you have an advantage, you're in trouble.
Right. So keeping within the focus here, still on the regional missile threats that we face from somebody like China, you're right. It certainly includes cruise missiles. Those are the threat of today. That's not the threat of tomorrow. You've got ballistics, including some increasingly maneuverable ballistic missiles. And by the way, RVs, when they come in, are hypersonic speed. And if they're moving around, that's a challenge. That would be the two things that jump right off, in addition to your standard fixed wing type of aircraft. But it's that cruise missile defense challenge. And so that means that there may be effectors. It could be SM-6, it could be ESSM, but there's Navy effectors out there today that have been designed to protect the fleet. And so while the Army's FPIC program isn't quite there yet, there are some other alternatives out there. But it may be that there's an Air Force solution or a Navy solution. And it doesn't have to be in any one service. It's probably going to have to be multiple. And by the way, you mentioned the hypersonic
right.
track. You know, I think it's very positive, the steps that are being taken on moving out, not merely on a very near-term solution, but a medium-term solution for what's known as a glide phase effector. That's very positive. I'll be looking to look at the PB-22 submission, and I'm hopeful that there'll be some attention given to the GPI in that budget.
I've asked you this question before, but I always feel like it's an evolving situation. So every couple of months, whenever we talk, it's good to get your sense on it, right? I mean, there is this tendency of always making adversaries 10 feet tall. And, you know, those who are somewhat more skeptical of China's military advantages always like to point out, you know, they've got an enormous number of weaknesses. Don't make the mistake. We have a tendency of inflating them at a time when we want money to go to certain things, for example, right? From a capability standpoint and what you can read from publicly disclosed sources, how good are the new generation of Chinese, Russian, North Korean, and even Iranian systems in terms of their ability to reach out and touch somebody, particularly us and our allies, with precision?
Right. Well, look what the Iranians did. What is it, about 15 months ago in their attack on al-Assad in Iraq? They used just ballistic missiles, and they did so with some pretty remarkable precision to hit targets on that base. And what the Iranians can do, what they've demonstrated that they can do, the Chinese can do orders of magnitude more. I think you're right about the whole 10 feet tall thing. I guess I would interpret that to mean that therefore you don't give up and think about these challenges as unsurmountable. But, you know, the Chinese and other folks have been investing disproportionately in their missile force, right? Because it allows them to reach out and structure an attack that is very quick, and to hold our various things at risk. So yeah, you mentioned DF-21, 26, and all this, but it's more than that. And they're building them in number and scale. So those are the threats that are here today. I think you're right about the, it's important not to dismiss, but also not to throw up your hands in resignation about the hypersonic challenge as well. I believe that it's not going to be easy, but hypersonic defense is fundamentally a complex form of air defense, and that we're pretty good at air defense. The nice thing about hypersonic glider type things is that, or hypersonic cruise missiles, is that they don't have the discrimination challenge of a ballistic missile threat cloud that's out there in space, and you got all these other things floating around. You don't know what the bad object is versus other things. So you don't have the discrimination challenge because friction pulls everything else out. You just have one hotter object that you got to find. And if you can track that, you can detect that and track that, then we can find a way to kill it.
Let me take you to the last element of this, which is national missile defense, the most religious part of the debate and the discussion. Where does this new administration stand on that? We now have two teams. We had Brian Roselli from Raytheon on earlier this year, obviously was pursuing the next generation interceptor. Northrop and Raytheon are teamed on that. They're going up against Lockheed Martin for the final contract. Talk to us a little bit about the administration's position on national missile defense.
Well, to stick with your metaphor there, Vago, I'd like to think that the religious wars of the past are in the rearview mirror here. And I see a lot of ecumenism here. What was the first major acquisition decision by the Biden administration? It was to move out on a new plan, the next generation interceptor. That's a serious investment. It's also, by the way, not going to be done quickly. We're going to take our time. We're going to have a conservative acquisition approach on that. So, you know, there is temperamentally between different political tribes, different approaches on terms of, you know, how quickly do you go on acquisition versus a little more traditional. They're going to go a little more traditional. I think, frankly, that's a good thing to make sure that we get the design and testing and the competition all right on that. That having said that, that's not going to be here until 2028. And what that means, what this different approach means for homeland ICBM defense, is that we're going to have to, in the first instance, accept and manage that risk that we're going to take between now and the 2028 timeframe. We have to manage that risk from North Korea in some way. I think we're probably going to manage that risk with increasing missile defeat capability. So think about our own hypersonic and, for that matter, supersonic and subsonic strike capabilities to go in there and schwack things on the ground or minimize the threat picture that we might have on a very bad day with North Korea. I think missile defeat, therefore, before launch, will help contribute to tempering that overall picture. But we'll get there. We'll get there on the interceptor later in the decade, and I think that's okay. But in the meantime, there's also going to be a lot more opportunity to double down on the things that we were talking about a couple minutes ago, which is the regional focus. I think it's high time for a renaissance of regional air and missile defense. And so back to your cruise missiles and your UAS, or counter UAS and all that kind of stuff. Those are the threats that are here. Those are the threats that are going to be facing U.S. forces over there in a tense situation. Those are all regional concerns. And so I think the administration may do some kind of a missile defense review. There was a statutory requirement for that in last year's NDAA, and I think that would be good. And I would think that some kind of a renewed focus on the no kidding, what are the theater and the regional threats that we're facing today, I think that would be a good area of focus.
Tom, of course, the term SHWAC is a technical missile defense term.
I think I've used it on your show before.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have. And I like it. It's like John Kirby using the term zorching around. So you've definitely staked out some ground on that. Let me just take it to the mud level really, really briefly with you, right? I mean, United States Marine Corps is acquiring the Iron Dome system for forward defense against cruise missile, rocket, mortar, that sort of thing. Obviously, it's a system that's operationally been very, very successful in Israeli service. What is the outlook for that and systems like that as we get into the guided rocket artillery side of things, right? Which for decades, there's been, you know, strategists have said, this is going to be a problem. And whenever we get into the mix, this is going to be an issue and we need defenses at this, right? So it can't just be aircraft, it can't just be Avengers, and it can't just be the, you know, the bigger weapons. We really have to start looking at that lower level. What's the outlook for that, irrespective of potential contractor involved?
Right. Yeah, well, look, I think, again, this is where the threat is, and the cruise missile defense problem, again, is one of our bigger gaping liabilities here. And so that's why I think the Army is going forward with this shoot off this fall for the IFPC program. I think some version variant, I guess, of the Tamir will be presumably involved in that. And look, there'll be different solutions. The important thing is to come up with the best product and acquisition strategy for that, because the demand is so high.
And then finally, Tom, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you the question of some controversy. The Chief of Air Force Global Strike Command, General Tim Ray, raised concerns about the Army's long-range precision strike agenda, saying that at those very, very long ranges, it could be a bankrupting equation if you're talking about strategic missiles that are in sort of the tens of millions of dollars or many, many millions of dollars category. That drew, I think, a bit of a rebuke from senior levels of the Pentagon. Where do you fall on this debate? Because, you know, the unfortunate thing is that roughly every 15 years, the Army does try to reinvent the Air Force. You know, what are the equities? What are the lines? What are the capabilities, right? What's reasonable and what's not? Because I think some people do make a legitimate case that, look, I mean, if two or three missiles are the equivalent of a tactical fighter, that may not make sense to be shooting a lot of them over the horizon. What's your sense on this?
I guess I have a slightly different take. And of course, General Ray is a very thoughtful commentator on these things. But the challenges that we're up against today with China is a very different challenge than what we faced with, let's just say, Afghanistan or Iraq or all this kind of stuff. And I've been struck by the arguments being made in the public. It is budget season, so I guess all's fair. But the arguments out there, you know, talking about the cost differential between this missile and that sort of thing, you know, they're saying, well, we can fill the aerial trucks with JDAMs and they're really cheap. Well, that's only useful if you can get there, if you can get your aircraft there. So, you know, this is, as the commandant of the Marine Corps has said, this is what we're witnessing is the emergence of a new era of missile warfare, which basically means an era of standoff capability. And so there is going to be an increasing premium on standoff missiles of various kinds. And I confess, I think that General Hyten is right to emphasize that every service is going to need to contribute to the deep strike mission here. Look, the Army didn't start doing long-range hypersonic weapon and pursuing a longer-range prism and other kind of medium-range capability. They didn't do that in the dead of night without nobody knowing. This has been in the works for a number of years. And frankly, this is the kind of thing that is presupposed in the joint warfighting concept that is about to be birthed here. So some of the pushback that you see from, I would say, a very vocal minority proponents of a particular service rice bowls, you know, sometimes new concepts get pushback. But I think that General Hyten's vision, he is, after all, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Indo-PACOM commander, he says he needs ground-based fires. You know, I think the Marines are right to be pursuing that with Tomahawk as well. I think we need to present the Chinese with as many dilemmas as possible. We need to complicate their surveillance and targeting job to the fullest extent possible. And oh, by the way, the Air Force, the terror and the beauty of American air power is a thing to behold, but we have to get those platforms there. The Navy's number of VLS tubes is going to go down over the coming decade. And I think there's a real contribution that the Army can and should be making in terms of long range fires. And I think that we need to let that go forward.
Let me ask you just very briefly then the last question, which is the cost curve, right? If you look at the sheer amount of hardware that the Chinese have built up and can expend at us, all from mobile launchers, right? So this is a complicated targeting problem. They've been very smart. They went to school on this, whether it's their ICBMs or anything else. Everything is mobile, right? There are no ground silos that you need to deal with. So yep. It's a lot of trucks, a lot of stuff moving around, and it's a big shell game. So you don't know which is loaded or unloaded.
Bingo.
How do we get on the right side of this? Because whether it's on directed energy, we're at the cusp of change, whether it's railguns, Chinese Navy already fielding railgun capability out to the fleet, right? We haven't yet done that. We have the Ponce laser out there, but not a lot more. What do we need to be doing to change this cost curve?
Right. Well, actually, let me first address the cost curve of the strike side. The Army's long-range fires, they're not going to be sitting in concrete, by the way. They're going to be mobile and transportable as well. That shell game, that mobility, that's part of the imposition of these dilemmas and challenges for the bad guys. So for instance, notice we need mobility of platforms at sea with lots of missiles on them. We need mobility of platforms in the air that, granted, they have to be refueled or land and that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, and yes, we need mobility and deception and decoys and all that kind of stuff on land as well. When we say multi-domain fires, well, guess what? Land is one of the domains. Land is a pretty important domain. And that's part of the equation. The other kind of cost curve that I think you're probably alluding to is the defense versus the offense.
Correct, because if you have a whole bunch of $6 to $10 million interceptors, you're on the wrong side of that cost curve.
Well, but connect it with what we just talked about. They're not disconnected. Passive defense, mobility, deception, that is all part of the cost curve, because that if you have to force them to fire 10 things to try to get you with one, right, then you have inflected the cost, the curve, or the differential. I think we got to come up with a better catchphrase to describe this relationship.
The Schwack curve.
Let me work on it. Let me come up with something colorful for you for next show. We have to have the passive defense aspects of this. We have to be more innovative in terms of cheap ways to deal with this. But at the end of the day, you also got to have a mix of kinetic and non-kinetic ways to get there. A huge potential for the scaling up of lasers and all that kind of stuff. That's great. But because there's things like rain and fog and weather, you're probably always going to have a need for some kind of kinetics. And I'll just tell everybody wants to get cheaper versions of those counter UAS effectors, of the cruise missiles, all that kind of stuff. So folks are attentive to that, you know, a cheaper Stinger, all this kind of stuff. That's a pressing concern. But the Army is also, to their credit, moving out on that directed energy stuff. And I think you're going to see that in the next couple of years for the maneuver shore rad and the IFPC. And that's General Thurgood, the Army's RICTO, and another commercial for you, Vago. We're going to have him out to CSIS to speak as well here in the coming month or so. So lots to say there. The cost curve is a little bit more complicated, I think, than the usual cost per Scud versus cost per Patriot kind of calculus.
Tom, thanks so very much for joining us. It's always an honor and pleasure having you on the program. It's been too long, and want to make sure that we touch base with you on a more regular basis. Thanks a lot.
Likewise. Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.